Hi, Alex.
Hey, Adam.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Liver Talks.
Yes, welcome
back.
It's
good to be back.
Great to be back.
So today, we had an interview with Alex.
With Anjana Pillai, who's at the University of Chicago, and the wearer of many hats that were interesting to us. She runs the HCC clinic there and helped develop their interdisciplinary team and clinic. She, I believe, is the transplant hepatology program director, and she also co-created and runs the HCC TAG conference. And so we had a super interesting conversation with her about the HCC landscape, but also about some of her experiences both creating and leading interdisciplinary teams, as well as creating a conference. And so I think a lot of the people we talked to may be a slightly more research focused. And so I personally thought it was very interesting to hear from someone who has really thrived and excelled within academic medicine, but done so through some different sort of paths.
So for the last segment, we thought we'd talk a little bit about the burnout study that was published in Hepatology Communications back in January, National Early Career Transplant Hepatologist Survey, Compensation, Burnout, and Job Satisfaction. It got a little play on Liver Twitter over the last few weeks, so I thought that maybe we would just go through it together and give our thoughts for it to end the episode.
Yeah, I thought this was a super interesting paper and definitely pertains to us, and I think likely pertains to a lot of the people that are listening who are either going to be early people within liver or are early people in liver, since we still have no idea who listens to our podcast. But so please stay tuned for that at the end of the episode after the interview.
Our guest is Dr. Anjana Pillai, an associate professor of medicine at University of Chicago, as well as the program director for their transplant hepatology fellowship. She's also the founder of the HCC TAG Conference, a multidisciplinary educational summit focused on advances in the treatment of HCC. It was held virtually last month at the end of March, but hopefully it will be in person next year, especially because I saw that it was held in Park City, Utah in 2020. We definitely want to talk more about HCC and how you managed to start a conference. But first, we're hoping you could start by telling us a little bit about your practice, your research interests, and your career and how you got there.
Of course. Thank you very much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be part of anything related to the fellow education. So as you mentioned, I'm an associate professor of medicine at the University of Chicago. I did my fellowship at Cleveland Clinic in gastroenterology, and then I did a transplant fellowship at Northwestern. I've actually had three jobs. This is my third job. My first job was at Loyola University, and then we moved to Atlanta. We have family there, and I worked at Emory University for about 4.5 years, which I loved. And then my husband's job kind of brought us, kind of wanted him back here. And so I was offered this amazing opportunity to work at University of Chicago, and which I took and I'm very grateful for because I work with some amazing people in this institution. So it's like a very short story of my career. Wasn't always that smooth, but
yeah, I'm sure. It's like a, I feel like you're not alone in kind of crisscrossing the country for medicine and for family. How did you get drawn into HCC within hepatology? Like, what was it about liver cancer that interested you?
Yeah, I just to step back, I actually loved liver because it was so multidisciplinary. I always kind of envied the surgeons because they're always together. And when I was a med student, I really thought I was going to go into surgery for a long time, and then kind of changed my mind towards the end of my third year and decided I really liked more interventional medicine, so GI. And University of Miami, where I did my medical school training, had a great transplant program and some, Schiff, Eugene Schiff is from there. And so you hear all these famous names. He wrote one of the seminal textbooks. And so I kind of got interested in liver just because it was so multidisciplinary. And during my fellowship, especially at Northwestern, because they have such a tremendous program there. This was, 2008, 2009. and it was already multidisciplinary and cutting edge, and they work really close with their interventionalists and oncologists, and I love that concept. But when I moved to Loyola, when I took my first job at Loyola, we at that time it was not a big program, and I had really envisioned myself being in a big program, but because of kind of the stock market crashed in 2000, you know, the housing stock market. So actually,
I heard about
it. PG, yeah. 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 Did you hear about you guys old enough to hear about it? I don't know.
Now I lived through two of these. So.
But, you know, that was kind of nerve wracking because I was a PGY 7, 8, whatever you are. And all of a sudden, like all my job opportunities froze. Because all the hospitals went into a hiring freeze, you know, mm-hmm. which was really kind of nerve-wracking. But Loyola was one of the few transplant centers hiring. And so that's how I started there. But we weren't able to really do multidisciplinary HCC because it was such a small program. At that time, they were only doing 10 to 15 transplants a year. But I'd always just kind of kept that in my head. At some point, you know, if we grow at Loyola, if I go elsewhere, this is what I'm going to do. And so when I was given the job opportunity in Emory, it was to grow that program, to develop that program. So it was started in fellowship and us just kind of waiting for the right opportunity to get there. I don't know if I answered your question.
You did. Yes, you did.
Okay.
Absolutely. And so I want to talk a little bit about that multidisciplinary aspect, and first from the patient perspective, and then maybe from like the healthcare system perspective.
Yeah,
because you know I think HCC is such a extremely nuanced disease in terms of the treatment because it relies not only on the nature of the cancer but then the state of the organ, and when you're seeing patients, you are preparing them for potentially different treatment modalities from a number of different specialties. And I, you know, we don't as fellows often get the opportunity to do that kind of counseling. And that's something that, you know, we will have to do, if we end up going into liver, which Alex and I both are. So how do you approach walking through patients through the diagnosis of HCC and kind of preparing them for the idea that, you know, things aren't always so straightforward, and don't always follow such a linear path to the end of treatment?
Absolutely. I think that is a fantastic question. And with this, I think the most important time that you have to give yourself and your patient is time during that initial visit. You cannot rush things, you know, because, and that's the concept and of having this multidisciplinary clinic is you have the ability to do that. So I start from the very basics, you know, just even like simple language. You know, someone thinks that they're coming to see you for a lesion versus a mass versus a tumor versus cancer. All those things mean different things to different people. You know, so I always ask, what is your understanding of why you're here? So I know where we're starting, you know, and then I spend some time talking about their underlying liver disease. Do you know that you have underlying liver disease? You know, shockingly, about a third to maybe 40% of patients don't know that, you know. And then, you know, okay, so you have your underlying liver disease. What does cirrhosis mean? And then I talk about the specific reason that they're here. And then I equate a tumor. I mean, I say a tumor in your liver, I mean cancer, I mean liver cancer, you know, so that they kind of hear it over and over, so that they really understand that. And I actually go through imaging. And many times, you know, our program is great. It's very integrative. So I can have the surgeon or the interventionalist even in the room with me. We're very fluid like that. So it helps them, you know, so it's no longer abstract. And it helps them conceptualize and say, okay, this is where my liver is. You know, we have education pamphlets and we'll draw, you know, this is your liver. And we have anatomy on it. And then we'll draw the lesion and then we'll show it on the imaging. So it does take time, but that's important. That's important. The patient walks away first understanding their diagnosis. And then when you're explaining all the treatment options, it becomes much more concrete and clear, you know, otherwise everything's so abstract. I mean, how many people really understand how the liver works? It's hard for, you know, it's hard when you're in training, it's a complex organ, right?
At least one person on this interview understands it. Yeah.
So I think the key is to really take the time, be patient, and put yourself in your, you know, patient's shoes. And when you see that they're kind of struggling, I just go back, hey, did this make sense to you? You know, and I also always encourage them, which is tough during COVID, to bring someone, because I think it's very hard to remember everything on their own. And then during COVID, we'd ask them to call their family member, you know, if they were comfortable, so that there was two voices. So I think just different ways of trying to transmit that information so that's not like a telephone game, that they actually understood. And then we do send them with written instruction, you know, this is what was discussed. And our success also is our nurse navigator, who's amazing. And she spends the time initially before the visit to talk to them, getting their information, and then after the visit, like wrapping it up and kind of navigating through the different specialists that they'll see.
Yeah. And I think, as you've sort of alluded to multiple times already, one of the increasingly not unique things, but at some point unique things about HCC treatment is how interdisciplinary it is, and how essential to the treatment of the patients and communication with the patients having a functioning interdisciplinary team is. And increasingly within liver disease and medicine more broadly, but certainly in liver disease, alcohol-related liver disease comes to mind as something that requires more and more of an interdisciplinary approach. So we were sort of curious, since you have at multiple institutions now helped sort of create and maintain these types of teams, what the keys are to creating, you know, the most effective interdisciplinary team within a medical model.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So I think the most important thing is that you need to have institutional and divisional investment, right? You can't start this on your own. So I learned a lot from what I did right and may not have done right at Emory, because that was the first program that I was able to have the ability to create. And so in both instances, you know, you have to go to your chair, you have to go to your, you know, whether it's the transplant institute and say, hey, this is, you know, I gave actually a formal PowerPoint, you know, this is where cancer care is growing. These are the other disciplines where multidisciplinary care is important. I mean, transplant is multidisciplinary, right? So you have to show the worth to the hospital, to the institution, because you're not seeing like 8 patients in a half day. You know, you're seeing like 4 or 5 because it is multidisciplinary, right? And so many other disciplines are seeing that patient with you if you do it correctly. So we have one space, one setting. So you need to get the rooms. You need to make sure that your, collaborating physicians are okay, that it's not 100% RVU driven, you know, that they're okay with that time. So the first thing is to get that institutional and divisional approval. And then it's a lot of communication, to be honest, you know, communication between your collaborators, picking the people that you think have the expertise, that are senior to you, that may have been junior to you, but have the drive to do this with you. So really trying to see who is, you know, not just in name, because you need these people very much invested in making your protocols, you know. And then, so once we had approval from the institution, from my chair, then it was identifying who the point person would be in IR, in oncology, in radonc, you know. So you need all these in transplant surgery. You need all those people, and then who their backup would be. And then we made algorithms. You know, this is our protocol to HCC or cholangio or transplant oncology. So we would make these protocols. We'd have meetings to make sure that it made sense, that it's evidence-based. So it's just kind of all setting the backbone for it, right? And then, you know, and just even things like, we don't think about like clinic space, you know, how many patients can be put in, you know, a place, right? I learned from Emory, I need multiple rooms so that people can flow in and out. You know, you just can't do it with 2 rooms. So we have 4 or 5 rooms, you know. So then, like, once you get started reevaluating very early on, you know, for the first year we had standing meetings. Initially it was bi-monthly and then monthly and then, you know, quarterly. And I think marketing is very important. You know, we would talk to the marketing team. This is what we want to do. And we need to know that UFC has this program available, because it didn't prior to me starting there. And it's not that it's a novel idea, but we were doing it for the first time at University of Chicago, you know. So marketing is really important. And then every year we kind of evaluate. I keep a running list of all these patients, you know, who do we see? What is the, like, kind of pie diagram of who you're seeing? And then you can kind of see the natural fluctuations in your own practice, and what you're doing, what the outcome is. And then academically is finding collaborators. You know, there are people that have been doing this for a long time, doing it well. So I have a group of people that are great friends of mine that are incredibly smart and are wonderful investigators that I collaborate with so that my patients have research opportunities. And with that comes trials for HCC to your institution, you know. So it really is a multi-step process, but I think the most important thing is once you have that institutional personal commitment and that every shareholder really knows that their voice is important, you know, that's your job as kind of the person, point person, to make sure that every single person in your team understands they're equally important, you know, and that it's not like, and then of course, tumor board, you have to have your tumor board. And so, you know, some tumor boards are once a month, couple of weeks, you know, ours is every week, and we have about 25 people join, you know, and we really, and it's kind of how, what you kind of set this, stage, right, for what's allowed. So in some institutions, it may be always the senior people speaking. You know, we have really a mix, you know, we have junior people, we have senior people, you know, I'm early mid-career person. And so we really allow everyone to have that conversation so we can hear, you know, some of the brightest people are people right out of fellowship who are on top of all the data, you know, but then many of the senior people have the experience of, hey, I've seen these weird things and this is what I would do. So I think having all those components is really key to making it last long term and not just something you try and, you know, nothing comes out of it.
When you're trying to get that institutional buy-in, what kind of data do you present? You know, is this like, are you appealing to like more like a financial side of things, or are you presenting like data on outcomes? Like what both. Do you think, like kind of
both. Both outcomes on surveillance, on curative options, you know, for liver cancer, you know, better to start early. I also like did research on where the HCCs were coming in. So like at Emory, before I started the program, a lot of the HCCs was coming into oncology, you know, primarily. And then there was a subset coming to IR. And it was similar here, was a lot of it was coming to oncology and then to hepatology. So you have to know where it's going before you can try to funnel things through your program, you know. And then, yeah, it's for the hospital to understand, hey, maybe these clinicians aren't going to have this X amount of patients in this half day, but the downstream revenue of imaging, of procedures, of surgery, of transplant, you know, it's hard to prove, right? It really is. Like to really give granular data, it's hard. And we've analyzed our data in the years and, you know, you can kind of get an idea. But you just kind of also need to have people that believe that this is the right thing to do, because it really is the right thing to do for the patient experience, you know. And I think that's the other big thing, that regardless of anything, this is really the right thing to do for the patient, you know, and for to give them the best options. Because you can imagine a patient comes in to see oncology, they will do what they know best. You know, someone comes to surgery, they will do what they know best. But if you put all these disciplines together, we can collaboratively come up with what's best for the patient and not just our own expertise. And I think it allows you to grow as a physician as well, you know, and be better for further care of your patients.
Since you, I guess you've been doing this for a little while now, I was curious, I wanted to ask you about how the delayed meld exception points for transplant for HCC, how that's changed your practice and how it's maybe changed the way that patients are treated through, you know, your multidisciplinary clinic. Is that, I guess I would ask you, you know, what changes you've seen and how you're treating people differently now in this new environment. And if also on a patient level, if that's something that you discuss with patients, or, you know, it sounds like a lot of it is counseling on very basic, you know, aspects of the disease. So maybe things like, you know, delayed meld exception points and transplant is something that isn't always brought up initially, but maybe something that happens subsequently.
Yes. So, I mean, organ allocation obviously is a really hot topic, right? So there's been so many revisions over the last several years and, you know, and the HCC allocation policy specifically. So I do think there's definitely benefits to it. You know, I think learning about the biology of the tumor is important. There's more data that has come out. Just because you have a small tumor doesn't really mean that that's you know, that you're good and, you know, nothing's going to happen. In fact, small tumors tend to grow and that sometimes act really badly, you know, and whereas you have a bigger tumor and it's downstage and they do very well. So I do think that allows us to have that time to understand tumor biology until we have better biomarkers, because we don't, you know. So we're still using AFP, we're still using the imaging that we have. And, you know, we talked about HCC taggers a lot coming on with radiomics and biomarker selection, but it's not there yet. So I think for those reasons, having that time is important. And I do discuss that with patients. You know, the first meeting, it depends. If they're a clear transplant candidate, we do talk about all that. But if they're not, then we kind of break it into silos. Like, these are your treatment options. You know, I look, right, I talk about their functional status. I talk about their synthetic reserve of their liver, you know, and we always talk about curative things, resection, transplant, you know, microwave ablation, those kind of things. And then we kind of go from there. So the allocation policy is discussed with them, you know, that you're not going to be listed right away and get a liver, you know, that there is a wait time. And people understand that too. It's hard for them, right, to understand initially, because it doesn't seem fair that I have to wait at least 6 months. And even then I have to wait longer, right? Because unless you have, you know, I mean, most people aren't that lucky to just get an organ right at 6 months. But I think once they understand that you're invested in them and that you're doing the right thing by them, people, I haven't had any patients, you know, lose their mind over it. It's just more, they're like, okay, are you sure I'm on the list? And, you know, I'm upgraded now, right? You know, it's those kind of concerns. And, you know, and waitlist drop-off, it is a real concern, you know, and, you know, and we encourage living donation, to be honest. You know, if someone has a living donor, then that's great. And as far as treatment, how that has changed our approach to treatment. You know, the earlier data had shown, like, in low MELD regions where you would get a liver, you know, at a MELD of 22 before the 6 month delay, you didn't necessarily have to do local regional therapy, you know, because these patients were getting transplanted so quickly. But then you also had some recurrences, right? Because just because they were small and within Milan didn't really always mean that, you know, a solitary lesion wasn't always just what it seemed to be. But now we do, you know, we tend to bridge patients because there is a waiting time, you know. And I've been, you know, in Chicago and in Atlanta, where Atlanta earlier on before Shared 35 did have lower MELD times, you know, and then it changed a lot during the time I was there. And we incorporated more local regional therapy. So I don't think it's impacted our practice too much, but it just makes you kind of think about the long, you know, this is the foreseeable time you may wait, you know, unless you have a living donor.
One of our meta focuses this year is all about health disparities in liver transplant. Our last episode with Dr. Nephew that I will shamelessly plug here, not for you to listen to.
It's our podcast.
You may enjoy it as well, but we just need to get one more listen. So
no,
if you could, that'd be great.
Yes, I will do that.
And thank you. But I think, unfortunately, HCC in some ways is one of the poster children within our field of interest in terms of racial disparities with, for instance, Black patients being sort of diagnosed later and having significantly worse outcomes as compared to sort of the overall population. And with a lens towards strategies, have you seen anything that's been particularly effective in trying to bridge or eliminate these disparities?
Well, I 100% agree. I think their disparities are clear all across the board. And, you know, one of the first things I learned when I first came to Hyde Park, which is a very interesting area, you know, where the university is, there's like a very wealthy area right there. And then the rest of Hyde Park, you know, is not, you know, there is a socioeconomically disadvantaged area that we serve. And one of my first conversations was with one of our GI researchers, who's very well funded, works with a lot of refugees, and just kind of explaining, I just went to one of our presentations, so it was about cultural norms and perceived attitudes towards, you know, trust in the system, trust in their healthcare providers. And it really kind of stuck with me, because it's not just educating the patient, but educating yourself, right? It's also providers. Like, are we looking at patients and giving them all the opportunities that we would mm-hmm. another patient, you know, that comes in with more resources? So I think it's understanding where the patients come from, but also understanding your inherent biases. Even if you think you have no biases, everyone has some bias, unfortunately, you know. And so for our program, things that we have done, you know, this is where taking the time, I don't care who comes to my clinic, you know, you're wealthy or not wealthy, you get the same amount of time allotted. So education, we do a lot of community outreach mm-hmm. and education. We do like CME events for providers, which has actually been really effective since COVID because it's so easily accessible. We can just hop on a Zoom. You know, we used to do multidisciplinary CMEs, but could probably only do like two a year because everyone's schedules. So this is like impossible to get three people to do an event together. But now, you know, we try to do them like quarterly. I also do kind of like an echo series with some of our community-based groups that tailor to our refugees so that they understand about mostly hepatitis B, some hep C, but liver cancer mm-hmm. screening. So I think it's just that education that's so important. And then for both, you know, in both aspects, like I said, and, you know, I haven't been here long enough to know if that's making, you know, I don't have data on how that's impacting or, you know, but we do keep list of our patients, you know, like I said, and we look at where they're coming from and their ethnicities and things like that. And it's something that we're definitely trying to study. And it's a hot topic, you know, there's grants being given out for this, right? Mm-hmm. Specifically, there are people looking at gender disparity, racial disparities within HCC. And then if you look at some of the patient preference studies too, you know, once patients are educated about like what a surveillance can do for them. Like, for instance, we just, with Nihar Parikh and Amit Singhal and I, we just published a paper on a conjoined analysis on patient preferences for HCC. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you would think, oh, would they just want to ultrasound AFP? Actually, they were more interested in getting the best mm-hmm. test, an MRI, you know, versus perceived like physical harms or financial implications. So I think it just kind of tells you if patients are educated and could understand what that does for them, and they trust the system, I think they will be more amenable to these options.
All right. So we have to ask you about HCC tag.
Yep. Which was our first,
your baby,
our
yeah.
first, and our first ad ever.
So what was your inspiration to create a conference? Like, what was the impetus for that? And then how do you do that?
Yeah, you know, I think I think everyone has very important role in academics, right? And you have to kind of figure out what your role is. And so I learned very early on that I'm not going to be a primarily researcher or write grants. You know, I did that in fellowship actually and had some early success with internal funding. Mm-hmm. But then because of some life circumstances and moving, and I realized that was not going to be what I do. So, and when I focused on my strengths, you know, I was like, I like to build things. I like collaborative things. I like education. You know, I've always loved teaching and education of residents, fellows. So when you look at, and then when you look at the concept of HCC or look at conferences, you also want to make sure that there is space for what you're doing, mm-hmm. right? You don't want something that's like overly saturated, for instance. So that was one of the things that I looked at, you know, is this something that there is a space for and how can we make it different? So I definitely didn't do it all on my own by any means. When I came to University of Chicago and work with Mike Charlton, who actually started NASHTAG. And so there was, and it had already been going for a few years. And he and I had kind of been talking about wanting to do something like this at HCC. But honestly, early on, I moved to Chicago when my youngest was 3 months old. So the first few years, that wasn't happening, just logistically couldn't happen. When it seemed like I did have the time, I was lucky enough to have a medical group or you need like a team that knows how to work conferences, right? So there was a team that through Mike that had run medically based conferences before called Focus Med, and that's how he did NASH Tech. So that was the hardest and easiest part. Once you identify that, like you have a platform, you have a group that can help you, then it was a lot easier. So then it was really like, what do I want to come out of this conference? And what I really wanted to come out of it is this multi-D effort that HCC is multidisciplinary. And I wanted to make sure, unlike other conferences, so it's a single topic conference that there was a space for, that all the directors were multidisciplinary, you know, so we weren't just saying it. So if you look at our directors, you know, and we got really lucky, everyone that I asked to join as directors did, probably due to Mike, honestly, such a big name. But, you know, I had Amit Singhal, who's a really good friend of mine, and then Julie Heimbach, who's amazing for surgery. Riad Salem, like, you know, amazing for interventional radiology. Anthony Alcuri for oncology. So we just had really good directors, and everyone seemed invested in this. And then it became a lot easier. You know, that first year, you're like, is this really happening? Was hard, you know, because once you have the concept, we had the agenda, and then and you have the company that's going to help you. But then the second thing is marketing and fundraising. I never fundraised for anything, you know, so that was like the other thing that I had to learn. And, you know, Focus Med helped me, Mike Charlton helped me. I think it really helped that, again, that NASH tag was already in play. So you kind of learn these things along the way. But our first year was a very small group. There was about 100 people within, you know, it was in Utah, and it was so great. I mean, everyone just left. It was just a positive feeling, you know, because there was no antagonism during the conference. There was a lot of real-time discussion allotted for it. That was the other thing that we really wanted. We didn't want to make it just a post-grad course. We wanted it to be that if you had an interest in liver cancer, or if you were a specialist that really, this is what you did, that you could come to this course and still learn all the nuances, you know? And so for that, you need a lot of discussion, and you need to talk about things that are not necessarily guidelines yet, but evidence-based and kind of moving into that space. And so like after the first, you know, talk, we were like, I was sitting next to Mike. I'm like, I hope this goes well. And then we saw all these people like standing up in line, you know, to talk and ask questions. And that was kind of what the whole conference was. And we got a lot of positive feedback about that because of the small setting. And because, and again, it was multidisciplinary. We really had multiple specialists in there just, and kind of like jiving at each other, but respectfully, you know, people really did get in there. And like, that's where the debates really came out, you know, that especially came out on the debates. And then we tried to do it like in a bigger platform this year, but people weren't like, you know, they weren't holding back, but it was always very respectful, and everyone walked away really liking the conference. We had positive feedback and a lot of momentum, and then COVID hit, of course, like literally like 2 weeks later. Actually, during the conference, we were like hearing things, and we're like, is this real? Like, should we be, you know, like people were lining up, and there was like, cause we were at Ski Resort, and they're like sanitation things. And we're like, oh, like, I wonder what it's going to be like when we get home. And
you really squeezed it in under the,
Yeah, I mean, it really was like for those that attended, it was like one of the last conferences that we were at the time. But yeah, I think for anyone, when you ask the question, like, how do you do this? I think for like people in training or early career, and I'm always really, I feel like I'm always learning, you know, but it's when you're given an opportunity, if you think you have an idea and you have support, you know, I really think you should go with it, you know, not make excuses of why it may not work, but really see how it can work, and then incorporate people that you trust to allow you to make it work, you know, because I think those opportunities are rare and you shouldn't waste them, you know. I mean, it has to be something you believe in. That's the most important thing, and it has to be aligned with your interests. But once it does that, you know, you have that, I would just say go with it, because it's something that I'm, you know, for HCC tag makes me so happy, to be honest. You know, the conference made me happy, and seeing my friends make me happy, and you meet all these amazingly smart people, you know. So it's really great for you developmentally too, as a, you know, as a leader, or as a, your research focus, whatever it may be.
It's really cool.
Yeah. We'll come if you insist.
sounds great next year. Then.
Perfect. Yeah. We'll see you in Park City. Yeah. And thank you for allowing us to give a free read for it last time. It was our first fully unpaid ad, so that was very exciting. Well, we've certainly learned a lot, but before leaving, we have to do the infamous and famous lightning round, where we ask you a few questions that really have nothing to do, or very little to do
tangentially
with liver.
Related. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love this. Maybe Adam, I missed this on the instructions.
Sure. We omitted that. You know, it's kind of our gotcha moment.
Got it. Okay. Go. I'm ready.
Okay, great. So the first one is, can you describe a time in which luck played a role in your career?
Yeah, I feel like much of my career was not conventional. And so just because of family obligations and my husband's job, which was a very kind of, I don't know what the right word is, how high powered or requires a lot of travel. So I wasn't really sure where things would go in my career. And I think I was luck would be Andrew Aronson and I have always been friends. And we were at ASLD ordering Starbucks. And he was like, hey, any chance you're looking for a job? And I was like, not really, because I knew secretly I was pregnant. he was like, well, think about it, because we have some openings. And, you know, I think that, you know, I know you love Chicago. So I think this would be, you know, you get to work with me, right? And he's a great guy. So that was complete chance, complete luck. And I wasn't sure if I should like go for it, but I did the first set of interviews just thinking like I was up for promotion at Emory, like maybe this will work out, maybe this won't. And then I was just kind of really, you know, interested, and I was just really, I was not looking for this job at all. So it's a very random stroke of luck. I'm very happy where I am.
I'm going to be drinking Starbucks for every 15 minutes at ASLD for the next few years now until I get a job.
Just to see, right? No, the key is you can't ask if they're hiring. You just
exactly.
have to be nonchalant.
Just stand there. Yeah.
A chai, you know?
Well, you know, if there's anything about Alex and I is that we're really good at playing it cool. So I think
I can tell that. I felt that vibe.
We're giving off that presence here on this podcast.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll ask one more to not take too much of your time up. But this is our favorite of the lightning round questions. What is your favorite type of liver cell?
Oh man. Oh. Well, can I say my?
You can say whatever you want.
You could make up a cell, and we probably wouldn't know. As we said, there's only one expert on this call.
I wanted to say like a hepatocyte, but that just seems so pathetic.
Hopefully none of our previous interviewers are listening.
Yeah, previous guests.
That's been a popular one.
There's a few who have chosen that, but you're right.
Can I say a cholangiocyte? Because I'm really fascinated by cholangiocarcinoma and bile duct cancers.
Great.
You certainly can.
Even though we're talking about liver cancer.
That's all right. This goes everywhere.
Throw that wrench in there for you guys. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Anjana Pillai, University of Chicago. We hope to have you back on again sometime.
I would love to.
Maybe we'll plug the conference next year.
Yes. You must come.
All right, we've got our plug for the pod this month. This time it comes from my wife's company, Centaur Labs. They have an incredible medical education app called Diagnosus, DiagnoSUS. So Diagnose Us, good as in us. and you can get it on any of the places where you get apps. What's cool about this is it has a bunch of different, essentially contests that if you win or do well, and you actually make real cold hard cash, which I know
I
you like.
Cash.
And it's all these cool projects that certainly for me now in GI allow me to stay a little more in touch with general medicine as well, some lung labeling, even some lung sounds and that kind of thing. And then more recently, there's actually a labeling of the liver and different sort of structures in the biliary tree. And so for the hep curious, that's a good one to start with. But something worth checking out. You can make money. You can beef up on some of your imaging and audio med ed, and you are helping power medical AI algorithms for the future. So it's a win-win-win.
All right, we are back. And as promised in the intro, I thought we could riff on the early career burnout study that was published in Hepatology Communications in January. I'll put the link in the show notes for everyone who's interested. So this was a survey study of early career hepatologists defined as less than 7 years out from completion of fellowship. They had 154 respondents to the survey. Most were primarily clinical and university affiliated, but there was representation from clinical non-university affiliated and those who have a predominant research career. The authors collected some interesting salary information, which I think is often a big mystery to those of us in training, as well as data on protected time, bonuses, incentives, and student loan burden. 35% of all respondents screened positive for burnout. Things that were associated with reduced odds of burnout were outside salary support, the amount of clinical support staff, and having more non-clinical hours per week. Things that weren't associated with burnout that I found interesting were student debt burden, base compensation, time spent working inpatient or outpatient. And I'll say that 45% of those that responded noted that their student loan burden affected their job decision, which, no kidding. And then in terms of job satisfaction, 78% were either satisfied or very satisfied with their current job. Of course, the flip side is that nearly a quarter were less than satisfied with their job. Predictors of reduced job satisfaction included weeks on call, while adequate clinical support staff increased satisfaction. Of course, only 44% stated that they had adequate support staff. Compared to the mean burnout rates for physicians in general, which is in the mid-40s, hepatologists reported less burnout, but still over a third have experienced burnout, and that's a lot. Alex, what did you make of this study?
So before getting into some of the things that I thought were interesting, one like fun fact was that evidently transplant hepatologists are only 4% of all GIs, which I thought was low since I only hang out with hepatologists, evidently, but...
Right, so hug your hepatologist. You're going to see them again.
And then one sort of thing that I was interested in for any survey-related study, as I think you've gone through this process and I have as well, is sort of trying to figure out what the bias is and who's responding. And so it was a little less than 50% of people that it went to actually responded to it. And usually I would think that maybe people that had more negative feelings, et cetera, would fill it out. But since this was in some ways a burnout study, I would think people that were more burned out would probably be less likely to fill it out. So, I mean, what do you think? My sense is that this may have been filled out more by people that generally enjoy what they're doing, and so may be under-reporting some of the negative outcomes. But what did you think on that front?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think you can go either way. You know, as someone who personally likes to complain, I'm always open for a forum. So I think you can, you know, I think that people who are burned out are sometimes maybe looking for a little avenue for them to sort of coalesce their thoughts. But I think you could argue it either way. I'm really not sure how the bias, where it would fall. I think it's kind of impossible to say.
And then in terms of the burnout stuff, because I know that we've talked about this off camera and also talked about it on mic with Dr. Perman previously. And I'm looking forward to seeing what his data shows, because that was very much more looking at burnout specifically, whereas this was more of a survey of a lot of factors for early transplant hepatologists with a lot of focus on salary and sort of work setup. I was not surprised by the things that were protective against burnout in the form of sort of increased support staff and increased non-clinical time. And, you know, my sense is from talking to junior faculty, that's a lot of the things that really seem to burn them out, that they're constantly responding to messages or never have time to sort of pursue these other interests that they have within medicine that has kept them within academics. And so I think this data was not sort of shocking, but quite confirmatory and clearly sets up ways in which, you know, programs and administrative people can improve the burnout rates in their department and probably lead to increased retention and happier employees.
And as two people who have never applied for or interviewed for a job in medicine, you know, in a traditional format, it makes me wonder how much this data will influence people who are negotiating mm-hmm. things for their contract, because you can sort of, you see, this is the first time at least I've seen salary data or clinic number of clinic days. You potentially could be negotiable in a contract negotiation published, you know, in an official way without just, hey, like how much you make? What do they offer you? You know, this is like the first time I think I've seen a good amount of data
yep.
that you can pull from as someone who has no idea and is going to be looking for a job soon. Both of us. Let me ask you, does this affect your interest in the field, or does it affect your concern with entering the field, or does it have any implications to you as someone who's going to be looking for a job soon?
I still want to be a transplant hepatologist in an academic center. So in broad strokes, no. I think to your point, it is helpful to have some sort of benchmark as to what starting salaries are, as well as what starting schedules are in terms of amount of call, as well as sort of protected time, et cetera. I do think the only thing that it might push me to do is, when looking at programs, if there is more than one program interested in hiring me, to sort of ask about what the protected time looks like, what the support staff looks like, and if non-clinical things, because this was the other thing that it showed, such as medical education work, are reimbursed in some capacity or paid for. Because all of those things seem to factor into how well junior faculty can thrive. And so those are things that I think I don't know that I would have asked about, but now definitely will ask about and would be helpful to know in comparing programs.
Like if you're interested in medical education, but you're basically losing RVUs to teach residents, you know, how does that sit with you? And, you know, you have to kind of, does that reduce your drive, or are you motivated to do that kind of teaching anyway, despite the fact that you need to make up for another time? I don't know. I think it raises a lot of really interesting questions across the entire spectrum, whether you're interested in med ed, whether you're just interested in being a clinician, whether you're a researcher. I think, yeah, seeing more data on these topics, I think will be really interesting.
Yep. The one other thing from the trial that I wanted to shine as bright a light as we are able to shine on, which I found completely outrageous, was the gender gap in pay. So even controlling for a bunch of different factors, and this wasn't hugely highly lighted in the paper, which is why I really want to drive it home now, even when controlling for a ton of different factors, women on average earned 8% less than men, which came out to just over $25,000 a year. And this is like the perfect example of gender inequity in pay, because by definition, everybody has the same amount of training and qualification by virtue of going through, you know, the gauntlet of medical training. And so it's just sort of outrageous that they're being paid so much less, and something that should sort of immediately change.
A reason why it's important to publish data like this is because now you sort of have this in black and white. I mean, this is out there. You can point to this and be like, pretty terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else on this?
No, I thank Dr. Chris and the whole group. It sounds like this was another collaboration from AST Lykop, so we can re-plug AST Lykop, which I should join.
You should have the
but yeah, it's clearly a great place to collaborate with other investigators within transplant hepatology for a broad range of different studies. As a reminder, the Dr. Russell Rosenblatt study that we talked about around the transplant meeting also came out of AST Lykop.
Yeah, they're crushing it. All right. Well, I think that's all we got for this month's episode. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you to Dr. Anjana Pillai. Goodbye, Alex.
Bye, Adam. And just so you guys know, we've already lined up June, and it's going to be a barn burner. So get ready for the June episode.
All right. Take care, everyone.
All right. Bye. Thanks for listening.